welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the actors, the cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, sound mixers, VFX gurus, composers, stunt coordinators, and more. You name it, and you know I'll talk to them. It's an interesting movie mix for you today, as you're going to hear from director Duncan Stiles talking about his new film, Neighborhood Watch, while director Lorcan Finnegan discusses his latest film, The Surfer. Both films are as different as night and day, showcasing storytelling creativity, and some incredible and indelible performances, most notably from Nick Cage in The Surfer. I'll tell you right now, this is one of my fave films of 2025, and definitely one of Cage's best performances. He just gets better and better with age, let me tell you. But first up, we're going to talk about Neighborhood Watch. I like this movie. I really like this movie. It's the story of Simon, who is beautifully played by Jack Quaid, a young man grappling with mental illness, who becomes convinced that he has witnessed an abduction of a young woman. When he reports it to the police, and they refuse to believe him, he reluctantly seeks the help of his neighbor, Ed, who is played by one of our heartthrobs, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, a jaded, retired security guard with his own troubled past. And he's not happy that he's retired. So that makes him grumpy from the start, which is very key in the relationship dynamic of these neighbors. As the unlikely duo delves deeper into the mystery, their pursuit of the truth forces them to confront not only the dark secrets surrounding the disappearance, but also the unspoken wounds that haunt both of them. Both men are wounded. Both are flawed. And we see them at different points in their lives and how they really, a developing friendship helps heal each of them in a manner of speaking. It's like turning the pages of a Hardy Boys book or a Nancy Drew mystery. I love it. We don't see enough mysteries. At its core, this is a mystery that has some great characters, some super sleuths, everyday run-of-the-mill super sleuths who are going to solve this mystery. Directed by Duncan Stiles, who you may know best for directing The Clove Hitch Killer, Neighborhood Watch rises and falls on the compelling mystery plot and the performances by Jeffrey Dean Morgan as Ed and Jack Quaid as Simon. As you'll hear from Duncan in this pre-recorded exclusive interview, he was drawn to writer Sean Farley's script for its unique and heartwarming dynamic between Ed and Simon. Duncan found it sweet, bittersweet, not overly sentimental. The script had a mix of elements, thrills, mystery, and comedy, which appealed to him and which he brings to life with a naturalistic look and feel thanks to cinematographer Luke McCobrey. After Clove Hitch Killer, Duncan was looking for something lighter, and the script was an easy read where he found himself rooting for the characters and wanting to spend time with them. The script's ability to create characters he cared about was the key factor that made him want to direct Neighborhood Watch. It took Duncan over a year to cast this film. It was shot on 18 days on a very tight budget, and it showcased Birmingham, Alabama's suburban locations, which played into the naturalism of the story that's unfolding. The editing process was very detailed, which you're going to hear Duncan go into discuss at length. So it was detailed, it was lengthy, and it focused on maintaining tension and humor, which was not easy to achieve. Jojo Draven's score, which is melodic and synthetic, just enhance the film's emotional depth. But what soars in Neighborhood Watch? The performances of Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Jack Quaid. Believable, resonant, and they make you care about Ed and Simon. You quickly become invested in these characters, particularly Simon, as he deals with his mental illness. As if the mystery story isn't enough, this is where Jack Quaid rivets you to the screen. His nuance and intensity when he has attacks, in quotes, will have you holding your breath, waiting to see if the attack will pass or intensify. And when this happens, Jeffrey Dean Morgan as Ed is our eyes and ears and heart. Build and his reaction is what we are feeling and seeing as we watch this. Building on that are some incredible visuals by cinematographer McCobry that try to give image for us for what Simon is feeling. It's just wonderful work on all counts. A big contrast to Duncan's prior darker works, this marks a shift in his storytelling as he very successfully balances suspense with heartwarming themes. So take a listen as director Duncan Stiles and I break it all down for you as we discuss Neighborhood Watch. Duncan,
yes.
Neighborhood Watch. Talk about an endearing film. I'm watching this and watching this relationship between Ed and Simon develop and grow. The performances by Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Jack Quaid are fantastic. Their chemistry is amazing. But throughout it, the whole thing plays like I'm reading a Hardy Boys book. This is an honest-to-God mystery.
Yeah.
And we don't see too many things that are actually mysteries. And that's what this is, Duncan. And you play it out so well. Your cinematography, there's a naturalism to it. You've got great visual grammar that you and Luke developed for this one. The editing, it's paced beautifully. It lets us sit on some things as clues, as Simon and Ed come across clues. It is really an endearing and entertaining film. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to hear that. Got to give credit to Sean Farley, who wrote the script and created those characters and pulled me in when I first read it.
Yeah, what did you think when you first got this script and you took a look at it?
Well, I thought this is sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was drawn to the dynamic between Ed and Simon. I thought it was unique and heartwarming, and it had the right. It was bittersweet. You know, it wasn't like too sentimental. I felt like it earned the feeling at the end.
Definitely earned the payoff with the final shot in the film. Definitely earned it.
And it was just a script that had a lot of elements, like a little bit of thrills, a little bit of mystery, a little bit of comedy. It was very funny to me when I read it. And I was in the mood to do something lighter than my last film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just the type of filmmaker that I got to be really connected to the material in order to do it. And this was the first script that I had read after Clowfish that is just easy. It was an easy read. I was rooting for the characters. I wanted to spend time with them. And I'm glad that I did. You know, the chemistry between Jeff and Jack was a lucky accident. I mean, they're both, they know what they're doing. They're pros, so they can. But you can't. There's a certain level of chemistry that you can't fake.
That's just it.
And
you needed that here. That's just it. And you needed that here with Ed and Simon.
Yeah, yeah.
You needed that extra bit of magic. How difficult was it casting this film to get Jeffrey and Jack?
It took a while to get the main cast in place. It took over a year. But that was mostly because when we first started going out for financing, we decided to switch the role of Simon to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because we thought we would have a better chance of getting it made. And that didn't go anywhere for a long time. And then I had known Jack. I met Jack after I made Clofitch because he was a fan of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I just naturally, like, thought of him, sent it to him. Around the same time, we sent it to Jeff. And they just happened to both be fans of my last movie and have had worked together before, which was a plus. I think that helped pull things together, that they had a working relationship. Same with Mullen. I mean, mm-hmm. the whole main cast is a reunion of some Watchmen, some... They were all free in Rampage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Jack and Jeff were in The Boys.
So you really lucked out that the schedules aligned, because I know Jeffrey is always so busy.
Yeah, he is. I feel super lucky to have got this cast at this budget level, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was super tight. We shot it in 18 days, and we were coming up against a hard out with Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side of that was the SAG strike that was kind of delaying the start. So it was a little bit of a live wire act, but got everything we needed. And Jeff and Jack and Mullen were all game for the indie filmmaking, and along with the rest of the crew down in Birmingham, everybody just like worked super hard to get everything that we needed.
Watching the two of them, watching Jeff and Jack, is really something. And to watch how you have paced this out, to see their relationship, the relationship of Ed and Simon develop. You don't rush it. Both of them are wounded in some respect.
Yeah.
And Jeff, I mean, he's disgruntled. He lost his job. He can't let that go. He's dealing with a hearing loss that he doesn't want to admit to. And then we've got poor Simon, who is just trying to cope with his illness, with his mental illness, and is doing everything he can. He's got Dee Dee yelling at him, "You got to go get a job. I can't pay for everything."
Mm-hmm.
Limited in what he can do.
Yeah.
So to see these two wounded guys, and Ed is so off-putting, and "Don't bother me, don't bother me." But something clicks in him. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, you know, I can still kind of be a guard police officer. So, yeah, I think I'll help the kid. And it just, with that, it just starts going. And lots of hurdles, relationship hurdles that they go through. But by the time you start the third act, the two of them are so connected and on the same page. It is, the third act sails by. It sails by. I couldn't believe the film ended when it was over. I wanted more of these two.
Oh, yeah, me too. I would love to do more with them. Yeah, they're a crime-fighting team.
They're a wonderful crime-fighting team.
Yeah.
Now, Duncan, when you read the script and you decided, "I'm going to do this," did you start visualizing the film so that when you and Luke got together, and I know Luke was your DP on Clovehitch, you were able to sit down and start developing a visual grammar for this? Because your visual tonal bandwidth is very important here. It mirrors your emotional bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not contrasting. They're running concurrently. They're overlapping each other as one. And I like seeing that in a story like this. So I'm curious about when you started visualizing this and then sitting down with Luke and coming up with the visual grammar to deliver what we have.
Yeah, the main concept was playing explain things kind of straightforward visually, which I took really far in my last movie, and I don't know, I just kind of, like, the movies that really affect me, they don't go out of their way to be flashy. You know, we looked at Midnight Run, mm-hmm. as a reference, and that was by Martin Brest, and I just thought it was very solid. It was like style and service of the story. So we tried to keep it simple in terms of coverage and where we put the camera, and like you said, let certain things play out. And then when Simon is having an episode, it goes more stylized. It yeah. goes very close to Jack, and it goes to wide-angle lenses. And the whole approach becomes like more subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And so those were the two modes. But in terms of like perspective in a normal mode, it's really like it's a dual protagonist story.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how we shot it, is like both of the characters have equal perspective and equal weight, and we just treat them. Like, I mean, I just didn't want anything to be distracting from their story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of, that was what led my intuition. And then, of course, I like naturalism. I like a certain feeling of coziness.
Mm-hmm.
Like a world that you sort of want to hang out in. I like craftsman houses and old suburban neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
I like the feeling of middle America and flyover country and, you know, sort of like an Archie comic book where you go outside and you're likely to run into somebody that you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's my general sensibility. But a lot of it was determined by what was available. You know, I'd never been to Birmingham before. I had three and a half weeks to find all the locations. And so some of it was in God's hands, so to speak. And I was very pleased with the way that it came out, given the limitations.
The location is fantastic, and you achieved, you know, you like the old, the suburban, the craftsman houses, the ones that really were built in post-Korea in the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what you have here. And these characters, this is where you would expect them to live. Because neither one, they're not upper middle class. They're probably not even making middle class earnings. Definitely Ed's yeah. not anymore. And poor Simon, you know, short of maybe getting money from the state, he's just got what his sister makes as a hairdresser. So
yeah.
the location is perfect. And it is exactly what you just described as what you like for a look. So you achieve that. And to find something like Birmingham, and you get that great abandoned lot, which works so well. And it's a nice contrast to the homes, to the residential streets. So every small town, Midwest, down south, back east, those suburban neighborhoods that have been around forever, they're going to have an empty, broken-down lot, abandoned lot, like what we see, right next to nice little family homes. So your location, you did a great job finding this, and then showcasing that and working with Luke. We really get a great sense when we're inside, especially inside Ed's home. We feel that suburban life, that 1960s almost suburban life, which fits in with why I felt like I was reading a Hardy Boys book.
Yeah, well, good. I'm a big fan of the Hardy Boys. Yeah, there's something really charming about it. And I got to give credit to Adam Pruitt, the production designer, who, like everybody else, had not enough time and not enough money, but he pulled a team together and was able to fine-tune the world to in the direction of what you're talking about, with like really really creating that sense that Ed is like a relic of the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, you see that with what's on the walls.
Not really relevant to society anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you see it with how his house is decorated, the chair he likes to sit in, the stuff on the walls.
He likes to drive.
Yeah, so you really put us into, you created this world, and you really immersed us in it. And because of the nature of the straightforward lensing that you and Luke did, it feels like we are right there with them.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to the DMV trying to get information. We are going to that abandoned lot. We are walking down the alley. We are looking for clues in the street. It's not voyeuristic. We are right there with them. And a lot of that, while you go straight forward with your shooting, there's some nice play with Luke has some nice play with the focal length when you've got foreground and background with Ed and Simon.
Yeah, and two-shot.
And I love, you got the foreground and background, and there's adjusting with focal length, depending on who is actually opening their mouth or saying something of importance at that moment. And you've got beautiful dutching in the third act when Simon comes rushing in to save Ed. That was gloriously shot, Duncan. Gloriously shot.
Thank you so much.
And you even have nice blood work. I have to tell you, nice blood work in this film.
Oh, great.
You know?
Yeah, it was supposed to be a lot more. But I think it's a good amount, and I'm glad it looks good on screen. Thank you so much.
The color of it is great, and the amount is great. When you look at where the injuries are coming from, yeah. Anything else, I think, would have been overkill. So sometimes having a limited budget, because blood isn't cheap, having a limited budget can be a help to you when you have to scale back on something.
Oh, for sure, yeah. This was all about embracing constraints.
Yeah.
And making the most out of what we had. And using limitations as an opportunity. I went into it with that mindset.
Well, that was a good mindset to have, and you used it to your best advantage. Now, how challenging was the editing on this one? Because you really wanted to keep that mystery going. You needed to build up tension. But you also have comedy that comes from the conversations between Ed and Simon. A one-liner here. A comment that, okay, Simon doesn't understand, or something Simon says and Ed doesn't understand it, and you get these great quizzical looks.
Right.
And you really want to sit on those, but you don't want to sit too long. So I'm curious about your editing process and the challenges that you and Cody had.
Well, as with all feature edits, after seeing the initial cut, I wanted to kill myself. I'm experienced enough at this point to know that that's normal. And then there was just like a month of going through the takes, and that was probably the most enjoyable part of the whole thing for me, was just feeling it out scene by scene and getting, you know, making myself laugh. Because I shot the movie, and then I took a couple months off, and so when I came back to it, I had an assembly, and I had a little bit of a fresh perspective. So I could go through it with Cody scene by scene and just kind of make it work for us. And then once we got through a whole rough cut like that, we did a test screening, and that went very well. That was like a friends and family screening, and that showed me some more stuff to fix. And then there was some helpful feedback from the producers about switching takes here and there, and getting more subjective with Simon's episodes, bringing those back a little bit throughout the movie. So it was collaborative, and it was mostly intuitive. I'm an editor myself. That's what I do to I make most of my income freelance editing. So it's just really like being in touch with my own reaction to the material.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely worked. Your collaborative efforts there worked.
The performances are so good. I went into this thing knowing that we were kind of up against it in terms of the challenges, but I knew that I had a great script and I knew that I had great leads, right? And so I couldn't mess it up too badly. And those guys, like, they know what they're doing. They delivered. And so just having that to work with, it's like I'm already ahead of the game. They did a great job.
Yeah, they did. And especially kudos to Jack. When Simon has his episodes, they are so heartbreaking, and the intensity that Jack brings to that. And then, because that's where the camera work gets different and stylized, and Luke really, when he, you know, pushes in on with an ECU, it's just amazing, and it's heartbreaking, and it just makes you love these characters even more.
Jack made himself very vulnerable, and he put a lot of trust in me, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. Amazing job. Very different than what everybody's seeing him doing now with Novocaine.
Right.
Now, another element of this film that you did not overlook is your score. Working with JoJo Draven, what were you looking for as a musical undercurrent here?
Well, that is a big question. I was looking for something that kind of started off, I wanted something very melodic and memorable, and something that kind of started off analog and slowly morphed into something that was felt more synthetic by the end. It was like a tall order, and JoJo, given the amount of time that she had, did a great job. The key thing was melody and having like clear themes, and then like an underbed to the tense sequences that would tie them together. And then in the end, having something that enhanced the emotion of it without being like overwhelming or cheesy. And I think that she nailed all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing cheesy about the score. So don't worry yourself. There's nothing cheesy about it. It fits this whole vibe. It fits the suburban vibe. It fits Ed and Simon. It's not jarring. It doesn't go against type that you have created with this partnership.
Yeah.
No, it works really well. The whole package works really well, Duncan. So I've got to ask you, Neighborhood Watch is obviously the other side of the spectrum from Clove Hitch. What did you learn about yourself as a filmmaker in making Neighborhood Watch? Because it is so different than what you have previously done. What did you learn about yourself making this film that you can take forward into your future projects?
Well, I think I like to please an audience, and I like people to come out of movies feeling good. And I was in a particular place with Clove Hitch. I was a little bit mad at the world, and just feeling a little bit. I don't know. I wanted to capture something really dark, like dark in a way that I hadn't really seen before. And with this one, I was more about, you know, I've got kids now. And I want to just make sure that I'm not making things worse, that I'm putting things out there that are hopefully making the world a better, more positive place.
Mm-hmm.
And I still love suspense. Like, the scripts that I'm writing, the projects that I'm interested in, they're all, like, thriller and suspense. So I kind of feel like I'm going to go sort of, like, back and forth on this tone-wise with the projects that I do, because I still am interested in darkness. But with this one, it was just like I needed to do something that was like about the power of relationships. And I've been through so much I've learned so much from being a dad and being a husband. I've learned so much about relationships, and I think it's like it's a very powerful antidote to a lot of what ills the world. Just connecting with the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is exactly what Neighborhood Watch does. We have two neighbors who never spoke, never knew each other. We see them come together and see a friendship build. And I love the fact that this friendship, it fills a void in each of their lives. Simon has no father, no father figure. Ed has no one because he's so grumpy. And the two of them, it's like they fill a need in each other without them realizing it. Of course, I think there is a moment of realization on Ed's part as we get into that third act, because Jeffrey's got some great knowing facial expressions that Luke picks up on the camera just beautifully. But you turned out a really wonderful, heartwarming, entertaining, enjoyable film. I love it, Duncan.
Oh, thank you so much, Debbie. That means a lot to me. It was a journey. It was an experience, and it's really nice to hear that you connected with it and that you enjoyed it with it. I really appreciate that.
Well, now having seen two completely different styles from you, I can't wait to see what you bring next.
Cool. Yeah. Me too. I got some stuff coming down the pipe, hoping to keep the momentum going here and not have such a long gap on my next movie. But it's it'll definitely be more mystery and suspense, and good characters.
Yeah, that's the heart of this one. Are your characters, Duncan?
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see what you do next. Job well done with Neighborhood Watch.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much, Debbie.
And thank you for taking time to talk with me about the film today. This has been wonderful.
My pleasure. Bye.
And that was director Duncan Stiles talking about Neighborhood Watch, which you can watch right now on various streaming platforms. And now we're switching gears, hitting the western coast of Australia with the sun and the surf and the sand with director Lorcan Finnegan, Irish director Lorcan Finnegan, mind you, with The Surfer. A total mindfuck and a batshit brilliant performance by Nick Cage. Needless to say, I love this movie. A psychological thriller directed by Lorcan, written by Thomas Martin. It's a story of a man called The Surfer, played by Cage, who returns to the idyllic beach of his childhood surf with his son, who is played by Finn Little. Yellowstone fans, you're going to love it. It's a small role, but seeing Finn grow after his role as Carter on Yellowstone, get ready. And considering that Finn is Australian, you're going to see him in his natural element. But I digress. The surfer's desire to hit the waves is thwarted by a group of locals led by Scally, who is maniacally played by Julian McMahon. Their mantra is, don't live here, don't surf here. Humiliated and angry, the surfer is drawn into a conflict that keeps rising in concert with the punishing heat of the summer and pushes him to the breaking point. That's so key in that we see any of you who have been out there in really hot heat and you look down at the pavement or you look off in the distance, you can see heat rising from the ground, particularly on asphalt, highways or your driveway, even more so than concrete. And that is what we get here. That rising heat is visual and palpable to us, and it equates to the rising heat and anger within Cage's character of the surfer. Cage is absolutely brilliant. No one but him could pull off this role. There is nobody who could do this but for Nick Cage. The film overall, it is an unforgettable, visceral, and visual performance and film. A psychological thriller that emphasizes color, lighting, and incredible camera work to create a nostalgic, hypnotic atmosphere that is contrasting wide open landscapes of, not really landscapes, but seascapes. We get, because this whole film takes place on the beach and this one parking lot. So there are moments when cinematographer Radek Ladzic will pull back and we get a panoramic vista of the beautiful sea with the surf, the white frothy curl of the surf as it breaks, the beating down sun, the blue sky, the blue water, the white, white sand. It is a visual, sumptuous feast. Uses close-ups to reflect the surfer's mental state. And it's just gobsmackingly lush and gorgeous, particularly that super saturation of color and the sun as it reflects off the pristine blue waters and the white on white sand. It really is. It is a visual delight. It is not traditional, but it is a light, bright experience. And I can't recommend it highly enough. Now, as you're going to hear Lorcan discuss, the script, initially only a few pages, evolved into this tale of a man's emotional journey, stripped of his material possessions and ultimately his sanity. The score enhances the dreamy, nostalgic feel. The composer is Francois Tétaz, and I like the score. I really like the score. And then because this takes place around Christmas, peppered in the background, and this is kudos to the sound mix and the sound design by Asa Hand, you hear Christmas carols peppered very faintly in the background. And they appear at some really interesting moments. So keep your ears perked for that when you see the movie. Lorcan collaborated very closely with cinematographer Radek Ladzic, whose work you may know from The Babadook, another film from Down Under. Editor is Tony Cranston, and of course, sound designer Asa Hand. But you put all that together to achieve the film's unique visual and auditory experience. Sound and picture go hand in hand here. Hand in hand. Don't need dialogue. There's dialogue, but you don't need it. It is the sound, such as the sound of a kookaburra, which has that every kid learns at some point in elementary school. Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree. Laugh, kookaburra, laugh. And that's exactly what we experience here at certain moments with things that are happening to the surfer. We'll see and hear a kookaburra laugh. It's just so much fun. The story is told from a subjective point of view, which allows us, the audience, to experience the surfer's mental descent alongside him. From a directorial standpoint, Lorcan was also attracted to the challenge of telling a story that takes place just over a few days in a single location, while creating this intense, trippy experience that mirrors the character's internal psychological state. And this also continues in the tradition of Australian New Wave cinema. So take a listen as Lorcan breaks down the surfer from cage to story to casting to cinematographer to editing to sound to score and even the appearance and importance of native snakes and that kookaburra. Hi, Lorcan.
Hi, how are you?
Very thrilled to be speaking with you about The Surfer. This is a weird and wonderful mindfuck, to be blunt. It is fantastic. It is visceral. It is an unforgettable, visceral and visual experience. Nobody but Nick Cage could have pulled off this role. And what you have done, your visuals and your sound tell so much of this tale. You don't even need dialogue. You could just watch this with no dialogue and understand what's going on. And that is a testament to you as a storyteller.
Oh, thanks.
What was it when you were talking with Thomas Martin about this story and you got this script? What jumped out at you that made you want to tell this story and how you thought you could elevate it for the big screen?
Yeah, I mean, the script was, this project started as a couple of pages and then it kind of grew from there with Tom writing an outline for us that he sent me, and I thought it was great, really interesting. But I think what drew me to it just like instantly was that it's a guy about a man who sort of has everything together, and at a certain point in his life he has money, he has a fancy car, but his personal life and his relationships are falling apart. But instead of him trying to deal with that, he thinks that if he buys back his family home, he will that will fix, like, the materialistic goal will fix all of his emotional problems. But instead what happens is he ends up being stripped of everything slowly across a few days. Is first of all the kind of physical things, his phone, his wallet, his shoes, his car, and then like his dignity, you know, his mind, in this Australian heat, and it, you know, so to me it felt like a Jungian journey, this strange kind of story that takes place over only a few days in a single location. Even though the location's quite big, you know, a couple of miles probably up the beach and the car park and everything. But is all of that just really appealed to me because it's challenging, and I wanted to tell it then through this very subjective point of view, like the audience going on this journey with Cage's character and experiencing everything that he experienced. So if you find yourself going, this is intense and trippy, I don't know what's going on, I think that's what he's happening inside his mind. So all of those elements were very attractive, and the opportunity for an adventure to go off to Australia and make a film. Because both Tom and I kind of love New Wave Australian cinema and wanted to continue that tradition of, you know, Walkabout was directed by a British director, Nick Rogue. Ted Ketchoff is a Canadian who did Wake and Fright. So we thought we could be outsiders going to Australia to make a very Australian film as well.
Okay, well, now tell me the truth, Lorcan. The number one reason was so you could go to the Australian western coast. Above everything else, the trip to Australia, that was it.
Yeah.
And this is one of the great things that you do here, and this is where your visual grammar is so important. Number one, you have one location, which is brilliant, the way you have parsed it out throughout the film into visual segments almost. But working with your cinematographer, Radek, who you've worked with before, and who I first took note of with the Babadook years ago, what the two of you have done with super saturation, the blown out sun, the use of color, the white yellow of the sand, the bright, bright yellow of the sun, the blue sky, the blue water, the creamy white curl of the surf as it comes in, and punctuating the yellows and the blues with reds of the Bay Boys. Most notably with Julian McMahon's character and his hooded, whatever, beach cover-up. And then you give us this great contrast between the wide open world is with these beautiful panoramic shots of the ocean, but then you're getting incrementally closer, closer, closer with your ECUs till they're extreme, extreme ECUs, the more into madness that Cage's character goes. That contrast is absolutely brilliant. What led you and Radek to go that route with that grammar?
Yeah, I think it kind of, the initial approach was through the character's understanding of the world that he's in. So, like, when he arrives back in this place, it's somewhere that he left as a child, and he's coming back in his 50s. So he looks at it from a very nostalgic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So nostalgia is going to play a role in it, and that the place has this sort of hold on him, but it has to be beautiful and hypnotic and enticing, and it almost put him into a trance, like it's just drawing him forth. And so that was sort of the approach into, okay, let's make it feel like that and have this sort of, we're going to be shooting outside in Australia. Nearly all the scenes are exterior. So we started out with that as the basis. We knew, okay, we've got blue skies, hopefully. We've got this kind of greeny yellow bush behind the car park. We've got this turquoise water that's very evocative of memory and dreams, and then you've got this like white sand, and he's, and then Nick, I put him in a sandy suit so he's kind of connected to the beach, and then you've got this weird sort of biblical element to the story as well, that is happening across Christmas, and the themes of sort of rebirth and you know, Julian McMahon's character is almost like a prophet, so he addressed him in red because very early depictions of Jesus wearing a red robe, like royalty, you know. But he's like an ambiguous character, so he's like, you know, is he a savior or is he the devil? So there's those elements, and you know, when he's trying to offer Nick food in the car park, it's like 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. So there's those aspects that were informing some of the color choices, but then also. Because it was, you know, across the story, it was going to get hotter and hotter and hotter, and he becomes, you know, completely delirious from the sunstroke and dehydration. So, the color, like I worked on a color book at the beginning of the film, assigning color values to various emotional things that probably nobody ever looks at. But to me, it was like. Having this yellow surfboard, you know, connecting to the, end up being putting above the tiki hut, you know, connecting him to his father, even though the brochure is yellow, but connecting him to the home that he wants to buy back, and then using these colors to push the temperature, like a lot of reds and burnt oranges and kind of browns and and we use then like in camera techniques, like using flame bars underneath the camera to create more heat distortion, and we use these P vintage Panavision lenses to create a lot of like lens flare, which to me always feels very much like you're looking into the sun and you know your vision is being distorted, and it creates an abstraction as well, because things aren't objective then. They're being distorted by the actual lens itself. And then these kind of super close-ups and zooms is sort of a way of getting right into the character's mind, because your eyes can't zoom. They can only sort of dolly and jib and, you know, track. But zooming always, to me, always feels like you're getting sucked into something. It's bigger and bigger, more intense. It's like a nightmare when you're like a child, you know, things get too heavy for you. But then to contrast that with the space was interesting to me. I also wanted to use, like, obviously there's all this sort of themes around masculinity in the film. I wanted to use Nick's face and Julian's face almost as like male landscapes. So I asked them both to grow out their ear hair and their eyebrows and nasal hair and everything, so that we could really get in there and see, you know, what a man's face looks like after, you know, if they're not groomed, with all their hair coming out of their lips and ears and everything. So yeah, I mean, and all of those, you know, ideas kind of, they're probably subtle throughout the film, but they create an atmosphere they play into the visual language of the film where all the themes then sort of percolate under the surface.
Well, I have to say, you know, I've never seen Julian look this quote-unquote unkempt before. And also, the whole red idea and the hood and all, I immediately, while there is a biblical intonations there. It also made me think of one of his great characters from Charmed when he played Balthazar, the head demon, which was all red and black, versus his attorney, Cole. So to see that, that immediately drew me into the ambiguity of Scally as a character. And yeah. I thought that was fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, Julian plays him very well. As well. Oh. He is ambiguous. Like, is he helping him or is he manipulating him, you know?
Well, and then you also, you bring in your editor, Tony Cranston, who you worked with on all of your prior films. I love the rapidity, the pace that you come up with, the montages of insanity and declension into insanity within the mind, and the drug-induced episodes as well. But then you give us some relief that I found very entertaining with transitional shots with nature, with the snake slithering, with the kookaburra, which I thought was hilarious because it's almost like he's laughing at what's happening. How challenging was this edit? Because then you also have your sound on top of that. So you've got Francois' great score, but then you have impeccable sound mixed in that matches your visuals with waves and wind. And all of this plays into the psychological terror and tension that's building. So I'm curious about the challenges you and Tony faced.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually really enjoyable because we actually had quite a tight post schedule, even though we had enough weeks, but we just didn't have any days off if we were to try and hit the Cannes deadline. So I think we only took a couple of days off of Christmas and then one or two Sundays or something. But that allowed us to just really get into it, and we got a good edit quite early on. And then we were discovering that, the more we played with it, the better it was. And, I mean, we were both inspired by Nick Rogue's editing style in all the films, really. And Tony, I think, maybe it was Don't Look Now, I think, inspired Tony to become an editor in the first place. So we always knew we wanted it to be a certain type of thing, and you know, there was some stuff that we were shooting during the production that wasn't in the script necessarily, but it was sort of images that I knew I would use somewhere. I wasn't even sure yet where I'd use them, but I had an intuition that I needed shots of his father's hand and this boy running on the beach and a figure in the water, a Nick in the water, and this kind of trying to link his past with his father and his future as well, simultaneously, in a kind of way that makes sense if you're in a dream. Mm-hmm. And when you wake up at times, it makes sense at all. You're like, oh, but hang on. So we enjoy playing with those elements and where to put them exactly and how to give the audience a feeling that Nick's somehow dividing as a person throughout the film. And then I worked with Aza Hand, the sound designer, on my first film, and we had a really good collaboration, but I hadn't had a chance to work with him again until this film. And he's great, you know, he loved the scripts and he had ideas based off the script. And started gathering wave sounds and animal sounds, and we actually used a lot of the actors when we were doing our ADR sessions.
Uh-huh.
We got the actors to make animal sounds, bird sounds, and calls, and I did some, and Aza did some as well. So sometimes the birds and animals that are part of the sound design are actual men trying get that underlying kind of weirdness penetrating, you know, throughout the film. And then Francois' score, we had it was really challenging actually to find the right music for the film because it didn't want it to be some sort of cliche music that would appear in, you know, a thriller or whatever, and didn't want it to be overly Australian, but reminiscent of some way. But again, that was the way we found that music was through Nick's character's psyche, in a way, that it was like him returning to this place and having this nostalgic feeling about it. So we discovered dropping a bit of Martin Denny, which we kind of gathered a playlist of different music as we were from script all the way to production. And actually Francois came down to the set while we were filming there, and he knew the beach from his own childhood. Not that many Australians have even been to Western Australia, but he hadn't been to this beach. And when he came for one of the night shoots, he saw that there was like apartments or houses in the cliff top that had I think it's a scene where Nick is still wearing a suit and he goes down and he's like looking to get his board back at night and ends up in a fight with one of the guys. But in the background there's a couple of houses up on the hill. Francois took a sketch of their position, and that ended up forming part of the melody for the theme of the film. So, which I thought was really interesting, but there's part of the musical exploration, anyway, was Exotica seemed to just click in our minds. Like Martin Denny invented this musical Exotica, which is created a sort of fake holiday vibe, like for people to feel like they were in Hawaii, as evocative of being somewhere exotic, but not using any like indigenous instrumentation. It was all kind of made up, and the guys in the band used their voices themselves, like to make bird calls and all sorts of weird stuff like that. So once we discovered that there's something interesting there, that like it was almost like Nick's mind had this dreamy, nostalgic kind of music that made him feel like his childhood. Once we discovered that, that's shaped the whole score of the film, really.
Lorcan, thank you so much. Brilliant job, all right. And I hope we get to chat again in the future.
I hope so, too. Thanks a lot.
That was director Lorcan Finnegan discussing one of my must-see films of the year, The Surfer. And you can see The Surfer for yourself in theaters right now. In theaters. That's where it's showing. That's where you want to see it to really get the full visual and emotional experience. It's just fantastic. And after I screened it at a pre-release screening, I have gone back to the theater to see it again. Because it is just such an immersive and enjoyable experience. So that is all the time we have today. Join me again next week for more entertaining, hopefully entertaining, and informative cinematic discussion. So for now, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.